I'm going to try to give this standing up because I think it'll be easier for people to hear. Reading the Braille may be a little tricky, so hopefully there won't be too many stumbles. Thanks to Shannon for that awesome introduction, and obviously to everybody here and to the people in the background who decided to let me come today. So as Shannon said, I am Dr. Matthew Weed. I'm president of Impactors Incorporated. I feel like I'm reintroducing myself, but hey, so I'm going to kind of skip over the introductory slide to some degree. Go to the next slide, which of course is the disclaimer statement. I have no conflicts. I have no things to disclaim. Yale did support some of my research with technical and a bit of financial support, and the rest basically came from me. Hopping along, let's discuss the scale of chronic illness in our country and think about some of the costs that it imposes on individuals and society as well. In 2010, there were 145 million people with chronic illnesses in the U.S. Simple logic suggests that these people were spending 145 million person years being sick in all different kinds of environments. Obviously, a person year being 1 year, one person. If you look at the recovery from shorter term illnesses and other things, you know, surgery, flu, giving birth, all kinds of things like that, you would add millions more person years to that total. And some work that I was just beginning to kind of really get into seriously when I was asked to move to UC Davis would suggest that if you look in terms of the number of people who are, you know, that 145 million person year time, patients are spending less than 1% of that time interacting with health professionals. And cumulatively, health professionals are spending about 1 million, something on the order of 1% of that of time relative to the amount of time that people are being sick. So in other words, health professionals are interacting with us in the clinic for less than 1% of the total time that we're being sick outside of it. The US government spends approximately $357 billion on programs for to manage disability in the US each year. And if you look at all other sources of healthcare, you see, or of long-term care support, that's another $275 billion. Caregivers will lose something on the order of $3 trillion in salary and retirement benefits in total between now and 2030. Women will take the bigger hit here because A, women lose more money in salary and retirement, and B, of course, unfortunately in our country, we still haven't yet figured out that women are just as valuable as men. 61 million Americans will give approximately 40 billion hours of unpaid care, and that as of 2009. This care probably had an approximate value of about $700 billion. Millions more health professionals gave some form of long-term care. Obviously, these are your home health aides, your home health nurses, all kinds of people like that. So these people were obviously involved also. An obvious bridge here to solve some of these problems are health profession schools. The question is, are they really addressing these issues very, very effectively? As of 2004, some publications in the literature that are cited in my presentation note that at least for nurses, the number of opportunities to interact with patients in the home and work environment as nursing students were decreasing. A variety of publications also published around that time, but also some published later, including one that I published in 2012, suggest that physicians are not adequately prepared to think about chronic illness and chronic care, and that our medical schools are not doing a sufficiently good job of training people about the extra clinical factors that lead to an impact on issues such as rehospitalization and patient non quote unquote patient non-compliance. And yet, we also have good data showing that when we do have experiences like this, and we've already heard about a couple of them, they strongly impact students' practice and ways of thinking about patients who have all kinds of chronic health needs. Unfortunately, as we will see in the following slides, a majority of health professions programs that responded to a survey that I sent out and we'll discuss in a minute do not expose their students to, at least don't require it, to the lives, to their home and work lives, to patients' home and work lives. And a majority of students, as we'll also see, when they're given the opportunity to do it, so they're not required to, don't choose to take on going out into people's home and work spaces. What, of course, this then leads to is a probable, woeful unpreparedness of many health professionals who, of course, like to call themselves health providers, that being something of a misnomer as far as I'm concerned, because after all, patients really are the ones who need to provide ourselves health. But that patients are, the health providers are not really fully understanding the issues that lead to people coming into the clinic, returning to the clinic, and oftentimes returning there unnecessarily. These factors are known to impact everything from people's health and well-being to our overall national productivity. How can we determine how frequently at-home or at-work exposures are happening in today's health profession schools? Well, one obvious way is to do a survey to see of health profession school curricula to see if they have something like this. Based on my own personal experience as a totally blind and very brittle type 1 diabetic, and data that I published in 2012, I thought, well, there's got to be a way to do a survey like this, and I did set one up. It went out to a wide variety of health professions schools, and the specific intent was to see if they give their students opportunities to learn how patients live and work. All programs who were contacted were emailed a survey asking whether they required students to be exposed to how patients live and work. If they required this kind of exposure, they were then asked how much time their students spent in that kind of exposure. If they did not have required exposure, they were asked whether they had opportunities for optional learning of some kind or other, and what percentage of their students were believed to take advantage of these opportunities. To be included in the survey, programs either had to give master's or doctoral level training. The one exception to this was RN to BSN degree programs, that for the simple reason that, of course, RNs are in many ways the front line for a lot of home and work health, so it seemed important to capture them as well. Some programs were doubtless missed because I only was able to contact programs who were listed on national advocacy websites like that of the American Association of Medical Colleges. Only the 100 largest RN to BSN programs were contacted. These 100 largest as listed by the American Association of Colleges of Nursing. Obviously, the issue here was that there are so many RN to BSN programs that making an effective survey of that total group was going to become very complicated. So I thought the 100 largest would be a reasonable sample. Here is a brief overall summary of the data I collected. We had 109 total programs claiming 8,140 total expected graduates. This after 1,291 programs were contacted. So the fact that we had such a low response rate may be suggestive of how important these programs think this kind of exposure is. It may not. It may just have been an artifact of the email survey, which a couple of friends who were involved, who are health professions curricula type people, thought that the survey was possibly a little overcomplicated. 32 programs representing 2,461 total expected graduates required some level of at-home or at-work exposure. 36 programs representing 2,748 expected graduates had optional experiences. Approximately 43% of the students were believed to have taken advantage of these optional learning options. 41 programs, so our largest set, representing 2,931 total expected graduates, had no opportunity for at-home or at-work exposure at all built into the curricula. No program type had all respondents requiring exposure, and at least one program in every subset did not require exposure. So obviously this is an indication that you don't need to get this kind of exposure in any kind of these things to be accredited, in spite of the enormous cost to our economy and the fact that virtually half of Americans are chronically ill. It's kind of scary that the accreditation people haven't picked up yet on how important this is. With this slide, I will note that required home exposure is colored in green, optional exposure is colored yellow, and no exposure is colored red. Medicine, which is of course the focus of this slide, came closest to something approaching an even distribution of programs with required optional and no exposure at all. Physician assistant programs had relatively low amounts of required exposure. I think that this is in part due to the fact that they require so much logged patient contact of their applicants before they get to PA school. Okay, so only RN to BSN programs had more programs requiring exposure than not. The same was not true of MSN programs, as you can see. Many physician physical therapy programs had various kinds of this kind of learning. They had also the largest respondent by numbers. Given the focus on occupational medicine, it's surprising to me how limited the number of required exposures for occupational therapy were. The three public health programs, as you can see, two had optional exposure, and admittedly, a lot of their students did take advantage of it, but one did not. We will quickly pass through pharmacy, dentistry, and and chiropractic medicine. You'll see that no program type, again, had a full requirement for this kind of exposure. As you can see in this table, the respondents varied enormously. I'll kind of pass over that table and just notice that the response rates, again, varied widely. The average number of required clinical hours across 102 responding programs was 1,417. The average number of hours of at-home exposure across only 32 responding programs was 87.7. Both response sets may underestimate the total number of hours of responses because I did not construct the survey to go far enough in asking how many hours of exposure there were. For instance, our top in clinical number was 2,000 plus. Anybody who's taught in medical school knows that third and fourth year medical students are oftentimes in the clinic far more than that. So if patients spend the vast majority of their time being sick or disabled outside of the clinical setting, and health profession students spend only about 1.8 or 1.9% of their patient exposure time seeing how we live and work, how can they possibly understand how patients experience disease and disability? It is particularly concerning that when students were given the optional opportunity to get this kind of exposure, more than half, 56%, chose not to get this kind of exposure at all. That may say a lot about the kind of psychology that both selection criteria and faculty impose on our students. How would at-home or at-work exposure for students improve empathy and possibly reduce the cost of healthcare? We have data from a wide variety of sources showing that increased exposure to patients at home improves students' patients' practical empathy. It also changes how they practice once they become health professionals. We also know that perceived empathy on the part of health professionals improves how patients perceive the quality of their care. Finally, the earlier students get an empathy training, then the likelier it is that that training is going to impact them. So if you get them freshman year of college, it's going to be much more impactful than fourth year of medical school. None of these variables conclusively proves that exposing health profession students to how patients live and work will definitely cut costs or improve our outcomes. However, I think a strong argument can be for home and work exposure can be made because of the fact that we get evidence showing that home health exposure can prevent healthcare problems, that perceived provider empathy can have positive impacts on how patients respond to their providers, and of course, because programs of this sort can really impact future practice. A large thank you to everyone, of course, for coming. To Ms. Jessica Connor, now a student at the Rutgers School of Medicine, who helped with the survey in 2014. To Ms. Leah Hanmer, who helped put the presentation together and is running the slides for me. Yay, thanks, Leah. And also to Yale University for technical and financial support for my research.